And you're listening to KTRU on 96.1 KTRU LP Houston, streaming live on your phone and on the web at ktru.org. From the Rice University campus, I'm Rishab Kathari, and you're tuned in to Thinking Different. The pace at which technology moves in medicine is astounding. It seems that every year we read new stories of engineers developing exciting new tools that find their place in medical practice. And very recently, researchers affiliated with the Texas Medical Center made a discovery that may significantly change how we treat complex electrical problems in the heart. The team found that carbon fibers can be stitched into the heart muscle to treat problems in the way the heart beats. With me is Dr. Mehdi Razavi, a physician and innovator at Baylor College of Medicine. As the Director of Electrophysiology Clinical Research and Innovations at Texas Heart Institute, or THI, he works at the intersection of medicine and engineering, seeking to develop novel solutions to his patients' problems. Dr. Razavi, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Rishab, for having me.
Sure. Now, before we delve into your projects in medical technology, Dr. Razavi, could you tell us a little bit about your background and what motivates you to explore technology's role in medicine?
Sure. I am a philosophy major. I grew up outside of Washington, D.C., in Annapolis, Maryland, home of the Naval Academy and the state capital for the state of Maryland. And I went to the University of Maryland. And I have always, you know, looked at medicine as a means of making a difference, for making this, you know, my ultimate goal, which is to make the world a better place with me than without it. That to me is the ultimate legacy, and it's something that I thought about a lot. Innovation and newer technologies was not something that I thought about. My dad was a physician, so it was almost, you know, in a kind of a traditional family structure, and it was also always assumed that I would be a doctor, and so I adhered to that. And it wasn't until I started interacting with patients that I realized, you know, that medicine has a lot of potential needs for delivering the best care for our patients. I think until you are thrown into that arena, the assumption is that, you know, that the physicians and the healthcare system, at least back in those days, there was maybe a little bit more innocence and less nuance, but that all the solutions are out there and all the problems have been solved. And I found out for myself that that's not the case. And I found that I had a knack for not only coming up with the potential problems that I'm facing day to day with patients to kind of crystallize those problems, but also that I had kind of an ability to come up with solutions. And that's how the whole process started.
Sure. Now, your primary sort of background is as a physician.
Yeah, correct.
So how has that influenced or changed your approach to the process of technological innovation?
For one thing, I realized that as a physician, I am in an envious position of being able to see what the needs are. One of the hardest things about innovation is to not come up with a technology and then go and try to say, you know, this technology is a solution to some problem. It's to actually start with the problem, with what the patients need. And you also realize that, you know what you don't know. That's really, really important when you're innovating. And so, for example, our first startup, which actually is now being clinically implemented and, you know, after FDA clearance, was a senior design project with this exact same institution, with Rice. And I came to the students because of their knowledge and excellence in engineering, something that as a philosophy major I had very, very little of.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that you have to allow folks who know their area of expertise, allow them to, you know, to contribute. And so that's kind of that background, I think, has helped me realize that.
Absolutely. And it sounds like the ecosystem in Houston has been very conducive to you. In what other ways do you think Houston specifically has helped you make these developments and think about problems in such a unique way?
Yeah, I think that, you know, Houston is, I've spent my, essentially my entire professional career after I finished my training here in Houston. And so it's a little harder for me to be able to tease out what is unique about it, but suffice to say that when I speak with my colleagues across the country, the opportunities for growth in Houston are striking. And I, you know, everyone talks about this being the largest medical center in the world, but left somewhat unsaid is that, you know, across the street you have one of the best engineering schools in the world, and, you know, a mile down the road, you have some of the best business minds willing to, you know, work with you. There is still enough space where you don't get hit by sharp elbows, if you will. Mm-hmm. I think that that's something that the other coasts are now starting to have issues with. But here in Houston, we're not quite there. It has been dramatic by my own, you know, experience in the last 12, 13 years, how much things have grown. But it has grown in a very comfortable and cozy manner. It has not grown in a and to create an atmosphere that's, you know, caustic and claustrophobic, like I said, like with the sharp elbow. So yeah, people, it's really easy and fun to work in Houston.
Absolutely. Do you see this trend continuing to where collaboration continues as it is, or do you also see some sort of crowding out happening maybe in the future?
Well, ultimately, some crowding out is going to happen, and I think that that's healthy. I don't foresee that, not even over the horizon, not yet, in Houston. Houston, if anything, is still working on its way to achieving, I think, that critical momentum where now you have the bigger companies, the, you know, for example, the Johnson & Johnsons of the world, they come in, they have their Center for Device Innovation here in Houston, again, another mile down the road. You know, that's one of four such institutions that they have in the world. And you need to have a few more of these things happen. My understanding is that, and I can tell you that those things are, there are talks with other companies to do this. And so I do think that there's still more room for growth before it becomes any kind of a problem.
I see. And that leads me to something that I wanted to get your take on, which is, what are some of the unique challenges that you've experienced working with the development of medical technologies?
Well, probably the single biggest one is the fact that, you know, the greatest capital we all have is time. And managing time and time management is probably the single greatest challenge, at least for me personally. Some people are intrinsically very efficient with managing their time. That was not a course that, had it been offered in med school, I would have gotten a very good score on. And so, yeah, it's been a challenge. You know, also as you were doing all these things, you're, at least in my case, you're starting a family, all these other issues that definitely need your attention. But what I have found is that I don't have, again, I come back to this often when people ask me, I don't have a hard time, I don't want to say delegating, but accepting what I don't know. And I think that it's really important that you trust the people that you work with. You offer your opinions, you have healthy debate, but you let them do what they need to do. And I think that trying to control every aspect of every project is probably one of the most corrosive things that you can do for yourself. I think ultimately you will end up getting burned out. And when people aren't having that sense of ownership in a project, they feel, less involved, then your outcomes will be suboptimal. And so I've learned to, you know, embrace everyone's input, and that has saved me a lot with in terms of time management.
So. Absolutely. And so it sounds like being willing to work in a multidisciplinary team and collaborate but let everyone do their own thing, so to speak.
Correct. Absolutely.
Is important.
Correct.
And I think that's a growing trend in medicine in general.
Yep.
What are some other trends that you've seen in medicine or maybe even medical technology that are changing the standards of care? And how do you think those trends are different from what we saw in this field previously?
Yeah, I think that probably the single biggest trend that I'm seeing now is a focus on patient outcomes. It doesn't, whether or not you can do a specific subtype of a surgery in a, in a unique manner matters less, or whether or not the new toy that you develop allows you to do a procedure from one, in using an a format or an approach that was, erstwhile not available. That does not matter as much as does this technology make patients less susceptible to having complications. That's one of the biggest focuses that these days you see in medical technology, mitigating the negative outcomes of procedures, mitigating the negative experiences, and specifically in this case, what I'm referring to is, I'll use an example, life-saving shocks to the heart to, sustain you in the setting of arrhythmia and to reverse the arrhythmia, making those shocks, which are profoundly painful, making them less painful. So it's a matter of do patients do better? Do they get out of the hospital sooner? And like it or not, the economic impact that that has on the costs incurred for different treatments. Again, for better or for worse, the realities are that cost containment has become one of the biggest factors that is looked at in the new technologies. And technologies that can manage to improve outcomes, make patients live better, and to do so with use of less resources tend to get priority these days.
Sure. So all of these things, long-term patient outcomes, cost containment, like you say, the minimalization of waste in medicine, these are all very important things to consider, and they're theoretical and maybe not very easily quantifiable. So when you're working on these novel technologies for disease processes that may have some standard of care already, how does your team determine that the project you are working on will absolutely be superior to things that exist currently for patients?
Well, I don't think that we ever know at the onset whether something will be substantially superior. You kind of have an idea and you kind of are willing to say, yeah, you know what, I might fall on my backside. And I think as an innovator, one thing that you have to have is a backside that is not easily susceptible to sensing pain or discomfort, because it's going to be tested for sure. I can assure you that. I know mine has been. And so we go in thinking that, look, there's a problem with what's out there now. This problem is real. It's tangible. It's concrete. And our innovation has the potential to circumvent this. And really, with that gut feeling is how things start often. Of course, reality checks will come down the road. But if you're asking in the beginning, no, we don't do surveys. We don't, we don't do, at least in our program, we don't sit around and tick off why this may fail. We usually say why it may actually be a success.
Absolutely. So what I'm getting from this is that failure is going to happen. And as an innovator, I suppose you have to be comfortable with that idea.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Right. Okay, so I want to shift gears a little bit, and I want to talk about the very exciting and relatively new development that I read about and that I mentioned previously, which was the carbon nanotube fibers,
Sure.
which supposedly are stitched into the heart muscle.
Correct.
Which is a very kind of alien concept.
Right.
Could you tell us a little bit more about that project and which patient population you're targeting?
Sure. So of course, the reason that that concept is alien is because the material that is used for applying this technology, the secret sauce of it, is unique and alien. And I'm going to give a shout out to Matteo Pasquale here at Rice, whose laboratory developed this material a few years ago. So to take a step back, what the most common cause of sudden death in this country is an entity known as ventricular arrhythmia. The heart has four chambers. Two chambers are on the top. They're called atria. The bottom chambers are the ventricles. The bottom chambers are the locomotives, the engines of the heart. They're the chambers that do the pumping to send the blood out to the rest of the body or to the lungs. And every heartbeat is associated with a single electrical impulse. So every time your heart beats, it's as if a pebble is dropping on a pond, and then the ripples from that pond spread out. And if the water in the pond is the heart muscle, those ripples are the electrical wavefront. Now, if you are in the ocean and a wave is coming at you, and the wave hits your belly, what happens? The wave doesn't go through your belly. It abruptly hits your belly, and it breaks. There's a wave break. And if you look at either side of your body, of your torso, you'll see little eddy currents. Well, in the case of the heart, when you have a heart attack, you have scar tissue. That's the definition of a heart attack. And just like your body sitting in the middle of the water, electricity can't go through scar tissue. So when you have your normal heartbeat, that, you know, the pebble has now dropped into the pond, but the pond now has a bunch of little, you know, individuals standing in it. As those waves start expanding, they hit that scar tissue and they break. And when they break, they can form those eddy currents. And when eddy currents form, you have an entity called fibrillation, which is essentially, think of it as a bag of worms quivering. And when the heart quivers, there's no contraction. And when there's no contraction, no blood is going out, and you lose consciousness. And a few minutes later, you die. And this is why folks will say, you know, they're sitting there one moment, and then the next moment they're not. Because this is a sudden event that can occur in the setting of a pre-existing scar. And of course, you know, heart attacks are coronary disease, which is the cause of scar, is very, very common, especially in this country. And so this has been a problem for, you know, ever since the Western diet took over. Now, the treatment to prevent this, the treatments are somewhat limited. You have medicines that have a host of toxicities and are frequently ineffective. You also can do something that I do for a living often, which is called ablation. So you go and you take that tissue and you actually destroy even more of it, but you're creating now essentially a moat around the areas that can cause this fibrillation. And by creating that moat, you're kind of isolating those regions and you don't have the fibrillation. Or what is now standard therapy, which is you shock the heart back into rhythm. But that's, again, not a preventative measure. That's not treating the underlying cause. That's reactive. These fibers, what they do is they treat the underlying block of conduction. They imagine, if you will, make your belly, as you're standing in the beach and the wave is about to hit it, make your belly able to accept that wave front, and the wave goes right through your belly. And if the wave goes right through your belly, there's no wave break. And if there's no wave break, there's no eddy currents. And if there's no eddy currents, there's no fibrillation, and there's no sudden death. In a nutshell, that's how it works.
Fantastic. And, you know, this is a fascinating new concept. Has it been implemented in patients thus far?
No, it has not. It's, at this point, it's a, you know, preclinical studies have been done. It'll probably certainly be a few years. I don't think more than 3 to 4, but it at least that much before we start having our first clinical trials or data coming out. But no, it has not at this point.
I see. And, interesting, it's a similar concept, but maybe a different part of the body. I was reading about your project, which is called the Early Bird Monitoring System. And this is something else that you've worked on. But it's also kind of intelligent in a quirky sort of way, I thought.
Yeah.
I was curious to get your take on that technology.
Yeah, it's one of my first, and this is the one that I was talking to you about when I said it was my first project that Rice really made a significant contribution. Maria Oden's class at the time, organizing the senior design project, and Alex Aravalos at that point was a senior and kind of took the lead. And basically the technology is, when we do our procedures, we use something that's called a vascular access sheath. A sheath is basically a hollow bore tube that glows into the blood vessel, and it serves as a thoroughfare for us to get access and exchange equipment and go from, put a stent through that to go into the heart, what have you. It's basically our highway for work. And what can happen, bleeding can occur around the insertion site of these stents into these large blood vessels. When the patient's laying flat on their back, as the bleeding is occurring, you often don't notice it because it's a leak. It's not a through and through hemorrhage. But over time, an hour, 2 hours later, you notice that, the blood pressure's dropped and the patient obviously sedated, so they can't tell you that they feel pain. So you need to find a way to pick up on this early. And, Serranus, the technology itself, this early bird technology, literally is the name is after the canary in the coal mine.
Mm-hmm.
It warns you by checking in real time and continuously the electrical impedance, the resistance to electrical conduction in the tissues around that sheath, by putting just four electrodes, circles around the sheath. And as blood is coming into that field, blood allows conduction of electricity at a much more favorable, the resistance to conduction is much lower. So this device is tracking almost in an intelligent way, and it sees that, there's a drop in that impedance, there's less resistance. And the reason for that lower resistance is the introduction of blood. So right there it says, blood is now being introduced into the space, and it will do so way before you will ever have notification with blood pressure drops. So it gives you the opportunity to intervene and prevent worsening of the bleed.
Yeah. And I think that was the most exciting parts about this project, is that when you're accessing a blood vessel for a procedure, rather than maybe nicking the vessel and causing a bleed that you may find out about later because the patient, is having problems, this technology allows you to see it happening before it really becomes a problem.
Absolutely. And it allows you to track it. So as you're trying to intervene and as you're trying to, mitigate it, you can see you appreciate in real time the feedback, is whatever you're doing working or not.
Absolutely. Right. Okay, so we have a few minutes left. I want to ask you, what are your long-term goals, or what is one really lofty goal that you have for the work that you do?
Yeah, I would say if I have an overarching ambition or goal, if you will, in my career, is for one day to enable what I refer to as imperceptible defibrillation. As you know, when this fibrillation that I was describing earlier, when that happens, the only real acute treatment is to shock the heart. Not to pace the heart, but to shock the heart. You got to give a big amount of wallop of energy, and that energy dissipates. It spreads through all the heart tissue, and that's why it needs to be a very big shock. And as you see on TV, people jump off the table. That's not an exaggeration. That is really what indeed happens. And so now one of our projects is using trying to spread out that one energy source by putting microchips or nodes, if you will, and spreading them across the heart. Say, instead of that one area with the large high energy, now you have 15 smaller centers which deliver their electrical output. Well, each one of those electrical outputs now, because there's so many of these nodes, does not need to be as high. And then what happens, you can bring that level to be so low that you don't, the patient doesn't even feel the energy that's applied. And then essentially at that point, you have imperceptible defibrillation. You resuscitate the patient and the patient never even feels a thing. That is our ultimate ambition.
And I imagine something like this is going to take a while.
I've got some time.
Great. Well, Dr. Razavi, I want to thank you for telling us all about your niche in medical technology and highlighting how important it is for problems, especially complex ones like the ones you described, to be tackled with a unique multidisciplinary approach.
Thank you very much for offering this platform.
Sure. That was Dr. Mehdi Razavi, a cardiac electrophysiologist and innovator at Baylor College of Medicine, discussing his projects that develop cutting-edge technologies to identify and solve complex problems. Dr. Razavi also serves as the Director of Electrophysiology Clinical Research and Innovations at Texas Heart Institute. Join me next time on Thinking Different for more conversations with leaders in the Houston community. I'm Rashab Kathari.